Bill Eggers of Deloitte, continuing our conversation on the seven mega shifts as part of the Government 2020 site that we have linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The first three, government as an enabler instead of a solution provider. Shift two, made for me, service delivery. Shift three, distributed governance. The fourth one appeals to me because I'm a baseball geek, Bill. It's Moneyball for government. But what I've learned over the years since the book Moneyball came out is that people have different interpretations of what Moneyball means. What's the context that you mean here, and how does it apply to government, Bill?
Well, this is perhaps one of the biggest areas. It means what we talk about is decision-making in government taking a scientific turn with data and analytics and psychology and using behavioral economics, where they become vital ingredients to policy formulation and governance. And the idea is that you move more towards evidence-based practices, pay-for-success programs, you're using behavioral nudges, and this is going to allow us to move towards a much more scientific form and being able to understand what's going to work, what doesn't work, and shift very quickly. And the hope would be that you would move towards less an ideologically based kind of policy and program delivery process and more towards this evidence. Now, you know, there's big programs going on like this right now with the administration. I would say it's probably one of the administration's top five major management practices now. But analytics is going to enable us. Let me give you a quick example. So we're going to come out with a study in a couple of weeks, Francis, where we analyzed 26 years of GAO reports and recommendations, 1.5 million pages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you're sitting down to read those yourself as a human,
that would take me.
It might take a little bit of time where you'd have an army of people. Well, we use text analytics to analyze those, and we were able to see all of these patterns in GAO recommendations and how what it tells us about the impact of that on management of government over time that a humans couldn't necessarily see before. And when you think about all of the text and all of the data that government has, that right now we have no, most of it's not analyzed. It goes into file cabinets or electronic file cabinets. But in the future, we're going to be able to make much better decisions through all of these forms. Now, this isn't easy stuff to do. But when you look at like the National Archives and all that stuff, they now have to bring all that to a digital form. And then once you can analyze that, what you're doing is you're turning text into data that you can analyze better. But I think when you look at what's going on in the sports world compared to government, I mean, that it's actually a night and day difference right now. Sports is becoming, some of the most sophisticated of any industry in terms of the use of analytics.
And money's driving that, because the decisions that you make based on that information, do you sign a player or not sign a player,
right,
is millions and millions of millions of dollars with one decision. About this particular shift, you write, predictive modeling and other types of data analysis allow the public sector to focus more on prevention instead of just reaction and remediation. And that really is the golden ticket. I mean, we hear that especially a lot now about improper payments,
right,
where you want to try to prevent them from happening instead of pay and chase. So getting this right in a number of different areas is potentially a really big source of revenue savings.
A source of revenue savings, a source of making our community safer. You know, police departments like in Los Angeles and elsewhere are trying to do predictive policing, where based on all these patterns, they're trying to literally predict where crimes will occur ahead of time based on what they've seen in previous patterns and deploy police officers there or other sort of protective means. But, you know, I think the one area that's really amazing is also looking at what it's going to mean from a public health perspective and healthcare. The more data that we have, to where we're able to nip a lot of these things in the bud ahead of time and deploys, is going to be really fascinating. Because a lot of it's going to go down to the individuals, even to where government, private sector are able to do a lot of this predictive analysis and then basically send that down to individuals to help them to make better decisions.
The fifth shift that you write about, Bill, is alternative forms of government funding. I'll let people go to the website and read what you're proposing, but how would alternative forms of government funding change the conversation as far as protecting or not protecting the honeypot that most people are used to and how that drives the way decisions are made. So much of it revolves around the budget and do I keep what I have or do I cede control?
Well, I think one of the major forms of alternative, so you're going to see a number of things going on. One, because of micropayments and because of digital currencies and everything, I think we're going to see a lot more of people paying just a little bit for, it's almost like a fee-based approach is depending on using certain services, and it's going to be much easier to do, pay that $2 in a mobile device, and we're going to see more funding occur that way.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to taxation. But I also think we're going to move more and more, again, combining the money ball for government with this towards these pay-for-success models where government is being very, very rigorous about paying either, you know, after the fact or as part of a precondition that they actually see evidence of things actually happening. And you're going to be able to chunk that up and be very scientific about it, I think. So that's going to be another form of financing. But, you know, lastly, the private sector is now with impact investing, with socially beneficial mutual funds and a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of private capital that is now going into societal problem solving that wasn't there 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And we're going to continue to see that sort of funding. And so you're going to see more and more of kind of governments going in with foundations and impact investors to try to solve problems.
Bill Eggers of Deloitte is one of the hosts of the Gov 2020 website, government-2020.dopress.com. And we have a link at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You list 7 mega shifts on that site, Bill. One of them probably is a little bit cringe-inducing, number 6, for folks who are in government now, and that's titled Just-in-Time Civil Service. The concept sounds a lot like what we're seeing in the private sector. You write, employees won't stick to departments, but instead will move from project to project. Governments will apply the consulting staffing model to their workforces. They'll also expand their talent networks to include partnership talent, borrowed talent, freelance talent, open source talent. All of those things we're seeing happen in the private sector now. Here's the one that I think might to give people a little heartburn. Robots, UAVs, and simple database technology will replace many of the clerical and manual labor jobs that once comprised an enormous amount of government work. Now, we're seeing some of that already, but you write, displaced workers will pivot to a new wave of jobs, many of which require close human interaction. What if I don't want to pivot to a new job? What does that mean for a lot of folks who are doing jobs now and are not necessarily into having somebody come along and move their cheese?
Well, Francis, if you look back at the federal workforce back in the 1950s, right, it was actually primarily clerks. It was, I mean, and they were at very low GS levels, mm-hmm. okay? And they were doing essentially administrative clerical tasks. Most of those jobs don't exist today, right? And instead, what's happened is we have a lot of PhDs and scientists of all stripes and everything, and the salaries have gone up because we require now the federal workforce much, much higher levels of ability and education. And so what we're going to do is we're going to continue to see some of that, but increasingly what we're going to see is that robotics and UAVs, automation, digitization is going to augment and enhance the work of those really smart people who work in the federal government. It's going to make them smarter and better and so forth. I actually don't envision huge reductions necessarily in the federal workforce. I mean, we've already seen it's, you know, we're down, what, 600,000 people or more since Bill Clinton was president.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been some of those. I think instead we're going to see the augmentation. And as I mentioned, some of the jobs will certainly go away, just as they will go away in the private sector, but it will lead us to be able to have more time spent on human-to-human interactions, which computers aren't very good at doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the Watson model, basically in those human-to-human interactions, you'll have government workers who will be able to rely on rich, rich data of what's worked in the past with each of those individuals to be able to make better decisions. And so I think that's the key thing to think about is how it's going to augment our abilities. And you know what? Let's face it. There's a lot of occupations in the federal government right now that there's not enough people doing. If you look at OSHA inspectors or all sorts of regulatory inspectors or people in the field, you know, we could use a lot more of those people potentially. And I think we'll start moving more towards that sort of a model where we'll be able to augment those workforces, but they'll be connected to deep, deep technology.
The last of these mega shifts that you detail on Gov 2020 is a new basis for national prosperity. And this one starts like this. Critics have long criticized both GDP and GNP metrics for failing to measure social success. Bobby Kennedy famously said, gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising, yet the gross national product doesn't allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It's a great, great quote. And it is very impactful the way that you detail the need to figure out a different way to measure whether we're successful as a nation or a government is successful as whatever its area of jurisdiction is.
Right. It's basically looking at, indicators such as what are the education rates? What does congestion look like? What does health indexes look like? What is happiness? And a whole variety of other areas that, much of the Western world are more important to people, frankly, than just what GDP is, which feels a little abstract. Mm-hmm. And so we actually are a sponsor of a big new initiative called the Social Progress Index. And that actually does this sort of a measurement where it looks at a measurement of all these countries and what's around social progress and these sort of indicators. The economic part was developed by Michael Porter from Harvard University, and it's a worldwide sort of thing. And it turns out that while the U.S. is at the very top around GDP in terms of the social progress index, we're down a little bit. We're down, I think, a number 12 or 13, and because some of those other social indicators are not as high as we see in other countries like Canada and Australia and New Zealand. Now we have a much bigger population and there's other reasons for that. But I think if whether it's at the state level, city level, national level, starting to focus on those and then saying, how can we use some of these other things that I talked about, which is business collaboration, nonprofit collaboration, to try to make big dents in some of those areas where we're not nearly as high as we are in terms of our GDP per capita.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I'm very grateful for your time today to talk about this work because it's really fascinating stuff. None of these shifts, none of the seven mega shifts that you write about are grounded in ideology. They transcend ideology, I think. How do you prevent or how do you suggest that stakeholders in government prevent ideology from dragging them down or slowing their execution? Because it seems to me execution of each of these is inevitable. They're going to happen. How do you prevent that ideology from dragging them down or slowing things down?
Well, it's harder and harder. Francis, my other book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government, was all about trying to move towards kind of an evidence basis and getting things done that needed to get done and getting the different parties to work together and basically relying on what works as opposed to what people think should happen because of their ideology. That book came out five, six years ago. And, to be frank, I think in some respects, things have gotten worse in Washington, more partisan, more polarized. And now I say that, but on the other hand, there are some reasons for hope. We have around this notion of pay for success and results-based funding. There's a bipartisan coalition in Congress which are pushing bills along those lines. If you look at people who care about management reform and these things like analytics and the future of the civil service and a lot of that, I think there's a lot of bipartisan energy around those issues. So what I'd say would be try to focus on a lot of those areas first where there's agreement on those two sides. And then secondly, we do, as Mitt Romney did when he was looking at their health care plan, originally doing it in Massachusetts, was he said, I want to just look at all the data first. I'm going to spend a year getting all the data and get everyone agreement around the data. And then we'll talk about what needs to be done. And I think starting to really focus on what does the data tell us around some of these major areas and major problems in America, get agreement on that. And then we move towards debating the different solutions.
Bill, excellent conversation as always. Congratulations on this work, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue as it progresses. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on again, Francis.